it's Diane. So great to be back with you. On my mind this week, the surprising contention of one of President Trump's lawyers that a sitting president cannot be charged with obstruction of justice. I wanted to find out more about that, especially as Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller seems to be bringing his investigation closer to the Trump Organization and family. Peter Zeidenberg, a former special prosecutor, weighs in.
The president can express a view about any case. I don't think there's any question about that, but that's different than saying whether or not the president can obstruct justice. I certainly believe that he can, and I think most people would agree with that.
Then I was thrilled to have the chance to talk for the first time with one of my favorite actors, Tom Hanks. Is that Tom Hanks?
That's Diane Rehm. Might recognize that voice anywhere.
First, Peter Zeidenberg, an attorney in private practice. He served as special prosecutor with the Department of Justice during the George W. Bush administration. Peter, on Monday of this week, one of the president's lawyers, John Dowd, said that President Trump cannot obstruct justice because he is the chief law enforcement official under Article 2 of the Constitution and has the right to express any view of any case. I think that surprised a lot of people. Is he on solid ground here?
I don't believe so. The president can express a view about any case. I don't think there's any question about that, but that's different than saying whether or not the president can obstruct justice. I certainly believe that he can, and I think most people would agree with that. Two presidents were impeached or almost impeached for just that very offense, Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. So I think it would have been news to both of them that it's actually not possible for them to violate that law.
What about actions before he assumed the presidency?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. So there's two different questions here. One, whether he violated U.S. law, and two, whether it's an impeachable offense. Obviously, you can violate the law before you're president. There's no question about that. There's a question about whether you can be indicted, a sitting president, for an offense committed either during or before taking office. And that is an open question, and it's never been answered. So we have to wait and see, you know, how that plays out. And whether a Congress would view it as such is a political question, much more so than a legal question.
General Michael Flynn has admitted to lying to the FBI about conversations with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Now, what further information is Mr. Mueller hoping to get from General Flynn?
He wants to know everything. And so Flynn would seem to be ideally situated to provide a big window on what was going up during the campaign, during the interim period after the election and before the inauguration, and then the early weeks of the inauguration. He would know, presumably, what Jared Kushner was up to with the Russians. He would know what Trump Jr. was doing. He would know what discussions the president was involved in with all those individuals, including Manafort. So there is just, you know, a host of information that I'm sure they're hoping and may have already gotten from General Flynn.
Help me to understand about President Trump's tweet. I had to fire Flynn because he lied to his boss. Now, tell me what that means in terms of Mueller's investigation.
Well, it's helpful to the prosecution because it helps establish that the president knew at the time he was asking Comey to give Flynn a break that Flynn had lied to the FBI. So if he were to be building a obstruction of justice case, which is commonly believed that he is, and I certainly believe he is, the fact that the president was informed and aware that Flynn had lied to the FBI, committed a federal offense while he's asking Comey to give him a break and let him go, that helps the government, the prosecution team, build an obstruction case.
I know that you were in the Department of Justice during the George W. Bush administration. Help us understand what a collusion is and how that differs from a conspiracy.
Collusion is not a crime. There is no crime of collusion. It's just become a very common description for the conduct. But conspiracy is the crime, and conspiracy is simply an agreement to violate a law, any criminal statute. Two or more people can agree to take acts which would violate the law. They're engaged in a conspiracy. So it's a little bit confusing, but basically I think that the terms are used interchangeably at times, and it can be confusing to the analysis.
But what then does it take to build a conspiracy case?
Well, what it takes is an agreement between two or more people to take acts that would violate a statute. So, you know, people have discussed campaign finance laws, perhaps, or the anti-hacking laws. Arguably, you know, you could perhaps make a case that this conspiracy aided and abetted or encouraged in some way the hacking of the emails or the dissemination of the emails. What's been discussed less is a statute called 371, 18 U.S. Code 371, which is a general conspiracy statute. And I think that it can be used in this context where it's a conspiracy to violate a function of the U.S. government. And that would be the election process. But, you know, these are all untested theories. I would say it's not an obvious, and I've read quite a few different takes on this, there isn't an easy fit for the conduct that's been alleged and speculated about, say, Trump Jr. and Manafort and Kushner really wanted to get these emails from the Russians, and they really wanted to the Russians to spread them around, and then they were going to relieve the Russians of sanctions. And, you know, that's all speculation at this point. But I mean, there is pieces of evidence that would seem to support that idea. It isn't 100% clear what criminal statute that would violate. Obviously, it would be egregious conduct, I think, in most people's view. But it's just not obvious what criminal statute is implicated.
Writing in this week's New Yorker magazine, Jeffrey Toobin points out three areas where you could build a conspiracy case, one using cash, one regarding WikiLeaks, and one regarding the hack of emails. Now, does any of those three in this situation begin to point to where Mr. Mueller might be headed?
I read the Toobin piece. I thought, you know, it was interesting, as most of his articles are, and I think it's plausible. He did not mention the 371, which, you know, not to bore your listeners, but, you know, I think that statute, the general conspiracy statute against a governmental function, I thought it was interesting that he didn't mention that. Mueller's got some very smart and creative lawyers, so I am confident they are really thinking through and exploring this. And the other thing, which could very well come to pass, is that it's a cliche about the cover-up being worse than the crime. In this case, it may be that there wasn't a clear-cut crime, but the political implications of this conduct of coordinating with a hostile foreign power to assist the campaign, if that were to have occurred, that there may have been so many lies told to help protect against that information coming out, that the bulk of the people being punished for this, if they are, is for lying and obstruction of justice and perjury. That would not be a shocking result, and I don't think it would necessarily be an unfair or unjust result.
And this week we heard that Mr. Mueller was seeking some of Mr. Trump's financial records from Deutsche Bank. The White House said that was false, also said seeking those records would be beyond Mueller's purview. Is anything off limits?
Yes, obviously some things are off limits, but to do a thorough investigation, it strikes me, is you're looking in a case like this for motive, and you're looking for leverage that the Russians might have over Trump, his family, his holdings, and you're looking for reasons to explain certain strange behavior. I mean, there's been plenty of writing in the last year or so by people wondering why it is, of all the public figures and private figures that Donald Trump has not taken shots at, Vladimir Putin is one of the few. Okay, why is it that Russia always seems to be spared any criticism? And one reason to wonder is, I wonder if there is some financial reason why he has been so cozy and friendly with Putin, despite, you know, our intelligence agencies telling us that they interfered with the election. So I think it would be an entirely relevant and easily predictable avenue of investigation by Mueller.
Okay, let's assume that the process does come to an end at some point. Could he indict or refer it to Congress, or do both, or neither?
Okay, so between now and when he wraps up this case, there's going to be a lot more shoes to drop, I would think. I saw a report, which did not surprise me, but I hadn't seen before, just today, saying that there is a likelihood or a very strong possibility that there will be a superseding indictment involving Paul Manafort and his co-defendant, Mr. Gates. And a superseding indictment means additional charges, which may, you know, who knows what they involve. Others could go down. And when they do, there will be criminal informations or indictments which will spell out further criminal conduct. So this will build, assuming Mueller doesn't get fired, and I think that that's a distinct possibility, I'm afraid, this will build a momentum. And who knows what Mueller is going to do with Donald Trump at the end of the day. My guess is it's something that it's a political decision that should be handled by Congress. I hesitate to say that because I don't have a great deal of confidence in what I've seen so far from Congress. But I mean, that should be how it's handled.
As long as Republicans control the House, the chances of impeachment then would be very low.
I agree. I agree. I think it's unfortunate that that should be the determination because, you know, ideally they should follow the facts. And, you know, it's frustrating to hear responses to facts and investigations by these investigators as fake news, you know, but I think that that's what a certain number are going to say. And it's a question of whether you get a majority who say we want to really look into this.
Peter, do you really believe that the president will fire Mr. Mueller?
It seems shocking to say that, but, you know, he did it to Comey, and that was a stunning event.
But
and
this would be different. He has been advised by those closest to him not to fire Mr. Mueller.
You know, we could, you and I, make a list in a very short order, as long as our arms, of things that the president was advised to do or not to do, and he did the opposite, right? So he takes his own counsel. He doesn't pay attention to what people around him are telling. And frankly, there are other people that's publicly reported who are in his ear, his unofficial, you know, kitchen cabinet, if you will, urging him to fire Mueller. There's people in the right-wing media urging him to fire Mueller. And that's where it seems he gets a good bit of his inspiration. So, you know, I think there are people in Congress, frankly, in the Senate and the House, need to Republicans need to speak out now and set up some bright lines and some warning flags. They did it a few months ago when there was speculation he might do this. Since then, he's been he has calmed down a bit. But, you know, I have this fear that he's been fed, frankly, a line of BS from some of his lawyers that this case is going to get resolved by Thanksgiving or Christmas of this year, and it's going to be over maybe by the beginning of January, and that's what's keeping him calm. Well, that's not going to happen. I can say that with 100% confidence. That is not going to happen. And I have a concern that when it doesn't happen, he's going to react very badly.
All right, one last question. What happens if there is an indictment and the Congress makes it clear it's not going to impeach? What happens and what's the process from there?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, no sitting president has ever been indicted. I find that exceedingly hard to imagine. That would a criminal case with the president would actually go forward. That would mean he would be showing up in district court in D.C. and you know, being subject to trial proceedings. I just do not imagine that that would happen. I think that even if it were to happen, that the criminal matter would be stayed somehow until his term was up, and there would be so much motion practice about that issue that would go up, I'm sure, to the Supreme Court, that it would effectively delay the case until his term was up. So I do not see a criminal trial involving the President of the United States in a U.S. District Court.
Peter Zeidenberg, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's actor, filmmaker, now author, Tom Hanks. His new book is a collection of short stories titled Uncommon Type. Is that Tom Hanks?
This is, well, that's Diane Rehm. Might recognize that voice anywhere.
How are you?
Well, I'm just delighted to be talking to you. There was a period of time when I was in Berlin, and for some reason, I think your show was on six times a day on the NPR station in Berlin.
Wow. So I want you to listen to a clip from one of my favorite movies, and then you can react.
Okay.
What? What is it? What? What? Are you, if you're hungry, finish the hamburgers. Eat the buns. Eat the buns. You're not thirsty. You're not touching the water, the orange juice, crab apple. What am I supposed to do? Make you a margarita?
I love that movie.
I miss that dog.
Did you have fun with that?
That was actually one of the hardest jobs to do, because we had decided to treat the dog like a dog.
And we ought to say that was a clip from Turner
and Hooch.
Hooch.
Turner and Hooch.
You made it in 1989. So
yes.
What was so hard about it?
In order to work with a dog and have the dog behave like a dog, that means you have to relate to the dog yourself. Oftentimes, dogs are doing tricks or they're doing a performed kind of like bit, and their eyes are really on the trainer that is right off camera or right over your shoulder. But we decided early on that rather than become anthropomorphic, Hooch, who was played by really two different dogs, one huge guy named Barry, I think, and another very smart dog named Beasley. Barry was the dog that I interacted with most because he could just kind of like sit there, and I had to get him to honestly play with me.
Huh.
And honestly look at me. And after a while, you can get him to do that with, you know, a little treat in your pocket or a treat in your hand. But over the time, it had to be a relationship between a guy and his dog. So I had to get to know that dog over the course of a few months. I had to wrestle with him. I had to get in his face. I had to smell him. He had to smell me. And even in that I remember that scene that we shot.
It was hysterical.
We ended up getting to this place with him in which we took all day Saturdays for about, I think, eight or nine Saturdays in a row, in which he was the star of the movie, and we just tried to capture his behavior with me all day long.
But did you end up loving Barry and Beasley?
Oh, they were just the most... They're magnificent, very peaceful, happy. They're called the Dog de Bordeaux. They weren't just Mastiffs. They were a very particular kind of French dog. You put the French spelling in there, Dog de Bordeaux. Look, I came home smelling like them.
How bad.
Those dogs were really magnificent pals.
I know you've been a very busy man lately. The movie The Post comes out later this month, and you recently came out with a book of short stories titled Uncommon Type. I want to ask you about one of your stories. It's titled A Special Weekend. Tell us about it.
Well, everybody asks if any of the stories are autobiographical, and the answer is no, outside of snippets of behavior that I myself observed. But A Special Weekend is the closest any of the stories are to being representative of me, and also my family. The story is about a 9-year-old boy who's about to have his 10th birthday. And his mother, who does not, their parents are divorced, his mother comes to spend a weekend with him. She comes and picks him up in a snazzy sports car and takes him back to their hometown that they lived in. And he's with her for a long weekend. And he has all sorts of adventures and with her, and gets to ride in a plane for the first time on the way home. And although none of those things specifically happened to me and to us, it is true that my parents divorced when I was 5 and they left, and I was not raised by my mom, and we had a series of very nice people my dad was married to, stepsisters and what have you. And I would say that the acceptance that the little boy has, his name is Kenny, the acceptance that Kenny has for his lot in life is what we all did. We didn't think it was unusual to have moved at an early age. We lived in 10 different houses by the time I was 10, and I was the youngest of 3, and I had a younger brother that lived with my mom for his life. But we didn't We never thought that other than confusing and a constant kind of upheaval that would come along every 18 months or sometimes 6 months, or sometimes we stay in a house for, as much as 3 years. We thought that that was just kind of the norm, but that did not mean that we weren't aware of some of the bittersweet aspects of it. And in the course of writing the story, I must say I stumbled upon a brand of empathy for the circumstance my mom was in at the time. There's a scene I call them scenes. There's a passage in the book where they pass the neighborhood that they used to live in, his old house.
Yeah.
And he says, "Mom, can we go by and see our old house?"
Right.
And she says, "Sure, we can do that." And they go by, and for Kenny, who's 9 years old, this is the only other house he's ever lived in. This is the only other home he's known, except for the one he moved into when his father married somebody else and moved 300 miles away. For a 9-year-old, he has a warm nostalgia for his past. There his bedroom window is, and there the tree is still growing, and it's not as big as it used to. And it looks like the neighbors across the street have moved, and the folks next door are not at home.
Not the same.
It's not the same, but he has this kind of magical and special connection that is overtly positive and yet bittersweet, because more than half of his life was lived in this house. For his mother, though, who was sitting in the car smoking a cigarette, she's looking at a house where all of her dreams died horribly. It's the house that she left. You know, she ended up raising 3 of the kids for as long as the marriage lasted, and her mother's hooked rug was in there. And there came the night where the years of extremely bitter compromise and anger and disassociation to her husband began. And so for her, she's remembering that the night she left, the kids were asleep and she didn't see them again for 7 weeks.
Wow.
And that it's a scar on the landscape for her. You know, all these short stories are kind of like decks of cards that need to have 52. I realize that a whole suit, the suit of hearts, was sort of the mother's story in there that I had to incorporate.
But you know, it does make me wonder how, having been moved 10 times as a young kid, affected who you are today in ways perhaps both positive and negative. You've talked a lot about this story, and it's as though it pours out from you.
Well, if you asked my older siblings, they would have a completely different take on it than I did.
Yeah.
They did not have the same, number one, good nature, I think, that I did, because I always, whatever house we were in, always had some action going in on it, because my older brother and the sister were sort of like running things. So I got to kind of treat it as every house was kind of like free time. But also, I found myself enjoying the newness of all of our circumstances. I'm an A-type personality, I guess, and for me to walk into a new classroom was actually an opportunity to cut it up a little bit in order to size things up and find my place in it, and you know, in some ways, seduce some of the other kids that there, because I just had a perspective that they did not have.
And how much of a cut up were you?
Oh, well, I was never one who crossed authority. I always got the teacher on my side.
Gotcha.
And I had I will say this. One of the great things that was quite accidental was when we all started traveling between my dad's house and my mom's house. We did that on a Greyhound bus, and it was usually about a 4 or 5 hour ride from Oakland, where we live, up to the small town called Red Bluff, where my mom lived. And because there were 3 of us, my brother and sister always sat side by side, and I would be in a third seat. And if we got on the bus early, I would get the window seat somewhere else. will tell you, on a number of occasions, some sort of malevolent person sat next to me. I remember there was one young guy who slowly got more drunk. One gentleman who started asking me far too personal questions. There was also like an old person, or sometimes I'd be by myself. But what I had there, Diane, which I think did an awful lot towards shaping me into what I consider my day job, which is, you know, telling stories on film and being an actor and what have you, is these trips were almost always at night, after school or at the end of the day coming home. And I had that window that looked out onto the world, literally the window of the Greyhound bus, which was this rectangular thing that had, in the daytime of the waning hours, oftentimes I would look at it, a sunset over the hills. And at nighttime, the lights of other cars and the railroad tracks and the passing homes and in those days, literally farm communities would roll by. And I would be lost in just imagining of what was going on in those, on those trains or on those farms or out there. And because of that, I was very comfortable being alone inside a vibrant world of my own making. There was a great power and I think an escape in just looking out the window and letting my mind wander. Outside of an occasional personality had to deal with on those Greyhound buses, I loved the time of just being alone and pondering.
Tell me a little about the movie The Post with Meryl Streep.
Well, it might have some personalities that you know or knew at the time. It's about Katharine Graham. It's about Ben Bradley. It's about Ben Bedbickian. It's about everybody else who was working at the Washington, the original Washington Post, not the President's Men Washington Post.
Right.
The movie takes place in about a week's time in 1971, and it just happens to be the week that the Washington Post Company is going public, which means they're going to sell stock and they're going to make an awful lot of money if everything goes well. It also is the week when Katharine Graham is forced to step up or step back from the great responsibilities of being the owner and publisher of the Washington Post, surrounded by men who made the decisions. Her father ran the paper. He gave it to her husband,
right,
who was a magnificent man, but who ended up committing suicide.
Phil Graham.
Yes, Phil Graham. And her son, Don, was back from Vietnam, and he was just beginning to work on the paper as well. And in that week, lo and behold, the New York Times publishes the first of Neil Sheehan's reports on what turned out to be the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
And Ben Bradley...
Your character.
I play Ben Bradley.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep is Katharine Graham.
Right.
And out comes all of the newspaper man's instincts in order to play in the big leagues. At the time, the Washington Post wasn't even the number one newspaper in Washington. The Washington Star was. And the New York Times was, you know, it was the gray lady of the nation. And they wanted to get the story. They wanted to compete. They wanted to be a part of what was at the time this blockbuster report that went all the way back to prior to World War II, that Robert McNamara said, I want to know, he was a defense, Secretary of Defense. He said, I want to know the history of our involvement in Vietnam. And so this study, 7,000 pages, was produced, and famously Daniel Ellsberg, who was not just an employee of the Rand Corporation, he had worked in defense and security agencies. He knew it was there, and so the New York Times got a copy of it, and the Washington Post got a copy of it as well, through, you know, good old fashioned newspaper investigations. Then the New York Times. They were shut down from by the Justice Department and the Nixon administration. So here in this one week, Katharine Graham has to become Katharine Graham. They have to find the greatest story that's going on at the time. And the Nixon White House decides to assault the First Amendment by ordering the cease and desist of publishing this report that was essentially the history of our involvement in Vietnam. And when the Washington Post did, they were threatened with treason. It was quite a, if they were found guilty, they all could have gone to jail under various acts. They were giving away secrets of national security, and both they and the New York Times had to go before the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court had to grant cert, I think is what it's called, or in order to say no, this is essentially the First Amendment, speech, religion, assembly, and the press. And it sounds like almost like a drier version of a white paper by NBC News or something out of Frontline. But in fact, it's a thrill a minute page turner, because it's about certainly secrets that are being kept. It's also about people whose lives and livelihoods are being put in danger. And it's about the grander scheme of, well, why do we have newspapers and what makes us Americans?
And I think that brings us almost precisely to where we are today with the accusations from many sources of newspapers, television programs, radio programs producing what they're calling fake news. So doing that movie as you did must have raised some similarities in your own mind to what's going on now.
Well, it was first read by our producer, Amy Pascal, in October, which then back in October, Hillary Clinton was going to be president of the United States. I read it in February. By that time, you know, the axis of the world had tilted. And so, yes, we had a new president. And the modus operandi of both him, both his and his sort of like team, his administration, was a different type of assault, I think, on the First Amendment. It's one thing to say you're not going to be allowed to publish this story, which is what the Nixon White House wanted to do. That's an assault on the First Amendment. 2017, we have people with an agenda that is out to dilute the search for truth, that is out to denigrate the efforts in order to report the truth. And in doing so, they end up elevating the purveyors of a truly agenda-based media put out by people who know what they're doing. They know that they're trying to spin outrage or fear or absolute falsehoods.
I want to ask you about something you said. You read through the script of the Post. What drew you to it other than the extraordinary factual history involved? What drew you to it as an actor, and how did you feel you could make that story come alive on screen?
There is the relationship that Ben Bradley had with Katharine Graham that is unique, and that I can't say I've seen in any sort of movie outside of movies about Queen Elizabeth. in that Ben Bradley was an absolute pirate when it came down to doing his job. He lived and breathed the concept of journalism. The greatest sin, biggest mistake you could possibly make for a man in his job was to run a story that was wrong. As he said, if you aren't right, if you put a story wrong on the front that is not right on the front page of the Washington Post, you have to eat that story for the next 24 or 48 hours. And it doesn't taste good. His desire, his passion, his fun, the excitement that he had of pursuing whatever the story was, big or small, was really in his blood. It's the food that he ate. Now, his boss was a woman that he was very much aware of that what she had been through. That she came from a storied family, but had no responsibility in that storied family outside the place of wife and mother. Her father was a legend. Her husband was a legend. The tragedy that surrounded her in getting that job was something that would break other people. And yet here she was, this woman who had so much at stake and had to, despite all of the anxieties that would come along with a job and also was in her personality. She had her wherewithal on the line, and it comes down to she had to make a mistake that was, excuse me, she had to make the decision that was going to define not just her, but and not just her legacy, and not just the corporation, but it was going to define the livelihood of thousands of people that were dedicated journalists and employees, and that respect, empathy, that understanding and compassion that he had for her was. It's tantamount to love. It's tantamount to a degree of caring for somebody that is when they discover that they're in it for the right reasons, that they share the same compassion, and that they are both learning in the midst of the great circumstances of a hellacious week for in the life of the newspaper. That relationship between Katharine Graham and Ben Bradley, it's a refreshing drink of water because it is based on danger, it's based on risk, but it's also based on love and respect.
You know, I was born and raised here in Washington. I've been here all my life.
And what were the family newspapers that you read?
Well, absolutely, the Washington Post and the Washington Star, and there was a third paper, a tabloid, called The News.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a young mother in 1971 and began understanding what was going on here in Washington. And as a radio interviewer and as someone who developed relationships with both Katharine Graham and Donnie Graham, her son, and then met Ben Bradley a few times, I'm telling you, the story takes on all the drama you are describing. It's really extraordinary. I want to ask you about another movie that, to me, was absolutely spellbinding, and I think had a great deal to do with the forward movement of the gay population in this country, and that is the movie Philadelphia, and what that was like for you making that movie. Did you feel you were doing a groundbreaking movie?
Well, I think the ground had already been broken in a large segment of the population.
Right.
Because anybody who was gay, we made that movie, I'm trying to figure out, I think we shot it in 1992. If you were gay, AIDS had already killed a huge percentage of that population. But it was corralled, so to speak, in that particular segment of the country, and it was not looked upon as being something that was affecting the rest of it. If you weren't gay, you weren't going to get AIDS. It was as simple as that was the assumption. And I think most people didn't want to know anybody that was gay, even the fact that they did. You know, there are gay people who worked in your bank and worked where you were and lived on your street and went to school with you. But it wasn't something that if you were, you know, part of the straight mainstream world, it was still too far away and removed from your daily life. I think when Rock Hudson so publicly got AIDS and then died of AIDS, that was a moment in society where everybody said, wait a minute, first of all, Rock Hudson's gay?
Yeah.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
And secondly, if Rock Hudson can die of AIDS, what does that mean to the rest of us? And there was a slow creeping of, I would guess, just information of acknowledgement that this was going on, and it was not just related to a few certain neighborhoods in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York City. When Jonathan Demme and Ed Saxon and Ron Nicewander, who were the director and the producer and the writer, came to me to talk about making this movie that was going to be about someone dying of AIDS, The bold step that they were taking was that they were going to make essentially a big budget motion picture about the subject matter. There had been small budget movies. There had been independent films that played film festival circuits. And there was a television movie called An Early Frost that had Ben Gazzara. So it was just beginning to be talked about in more households than before. But to have the movie studio say we're going to make a movie about the subject matter and we're going to put it into multiplexes, meaning that there will be a Sylvester Stallone movie up there. There'll be a new romantic comedy,
right?
And also there will be this story called Philadelphia. It's going to have Denzel Washington and me in it, and it's going to have the exposure of being a mainstream movie, and it's also going to then run the risk of, is it going to make money or not?
So, Tom, here's the thing: you talked about the movie. I asked how it affected you to be part of that movie.
The education that I went under in the course of preparing for the movie was extraordinary, because I was first of all, I read all the books of Larry Kramer, who is a great hero in all of this. I met with men who had the type of lives where they didn't come out of the closet for the longest time, and then they did, and now they have AIDS, and they're no longer with us. I met people who passed away because of it. And I asked very, very, sort of like blatant, almost clinical behavioral questions, like, all right, how did you find out you were diagnosed with AIDS? And I've heard stories about, they're in doctor's offices, and a guy in a white coat comes in and says, we have to talk, and I have some news. And they're told that they have AIDS, and they know what the route of suffering they're going to go through, and all they can do is look out the window and ponder, well, my life just changed. The nature of love and acceptance that you end up building around your character is based on his lover, the love of his life, played by Antonio Banderas, and the family that has always known that they were gay. And then the physical demands of doing the movie. I mean, I had to look like I was suffering from AIDS.
You bet.
And that required a full time approach to living in a different way. And the parallels, I think, for me ended up being then very, very physiological, because I had to go through a regimen that was, in fact, I mean, it was brand new for me. But if someone was suffering from the syndrome, their lives were 10 times more complicated than I was. They had to deal with constant medications and constant effects on their bodies, and as well as the preciousness of time, because their time on the world was limited. So going through all of that, I think any time an actor takes on a job, they're affected in some way. My son, we only had three kids back then, and my son Chester was just 2 years old, and he's a little boy running around in a little cowboy outfit, and he can't quite talk fully yet, but you play with him, and he's all I could think of was, what if this little boy was going to grow up and be gay and was going to come down with this, and I would have to slowly watch him waste away and die simply because he caught the virus. It was a very powerful 3 months of shooting the movie and 6 months or so of preparation for it to come out. And then to have it kind of defied a couple of logical moments, because oddly enough, it's this movie about love and acceptance, but it had a degree of controversy surrounding it.
Oh, sure.
Both by what it did and what it did not do, as a matter of fact. Mm. I mean, I met an awful lot of people who have said, thank you for, telling a story about my brother, or telling a story about me, or telling a story about the man I loved. At the same time, it came up with us like that was such a watered down version of what we're really going through that I viewed it as being very unrealistic. I said, and this was true, but I think the great here's the thing, Diane, is that particularly realizing it, the thematic purpose of the movie was to say, you know someone who is dying of AIDS.
Absolutely.
And for many, many people, that was me. And that ends up being a blend, I think, of definitely the power of power of the cinema. What it can do is empathize with people you never thought you would empathize
Indeed.
With in a million years. And also, I think the bravery. I know I talk a lot about the making of the movie, but the bravery of the studio, and I think of Jonathan Demme in order to make the movie. He saw something in it that was much bigger than the particulars of the plot of the movie or how we shot it. He saw something that was going to have a bigger resonance.
And it certainly did. I have one more question for you. Time Magazine has just named its Person of the Year. It's going to be #MeToo, which I love because it represents all those women and indeed some men who have experienced sexual harassment. Did you see this coming in Hollywood with this explosion of charges against Harvey Weinstein, Charlie Rose, now people on NBC, people at NPR? I mean, what do you make of it?
I can only speak from the most obscured point of view of the entire subject, and that is as a man. The common sense says this was a slow train coming. There are some people that are in this business to wield power, and that includes wielding power over those you have purchase over, people that are under you, and that goes not just from the telling of stories and negotiating of deals, but it also comes from hitting on them sexually. I think what is astounding is it and magnificent for our democracy in our country is the speed with which the Me Too movement has been empowered by the victims and the people who've been on the side of it.
In all the movies you have made, you have never seen that kind of behavior?
I will say no, not in an overt manner. Here's what I have seen. I've seen people fall in love.
Sure.
I've seen people flirt.
Sure.
I've seen people, have their lives altered. I've seen people whose lives have been changed. I've seen plenty of people who have had affairs. You've seen all the fabulous give and take that comes from the sexes mixing. I can't say that I have heard of anybody who suffered some degree of sexual harassment. But I will tell you this, part of being in a movie is being oblivious to an awful lot of stuff that's going on.
Yeah, I understand.
I'll tell you without now. I am sure that it happened on any number of movies that I was on.
Interesting. Tom Hanks, when do you think this is going to come to an end? Do you think that this rising up has finally brought it to light to such an extent that men will be far more careful, or is it just a pause?
Oh, no. I think it's a sea change. I think a Rubicon has been crossed. And what is going to be on the other side of it, and it's not done yet. I think a lot more is going to be coming down. And you can probably say they say it as a joke, but it's not a joke. I think there's an awful lot of men, and to some degree women in power as well, who are wondering what they've done in the past that is going to come up to light. You know, I made this other movie about called Catch Me If You Can. It was about a great thief. Leonardo DiCaprio played Frank Abagnale,
right.
He's a con man.
Yeah.
The Frank Abagnale does magnificent work now in regards to security, but he also said this thing about ethics. Because he deals with theft, you know, he deals with like company theft. That sooner or later, if you work for a company, you start stealing, you know, stationery out of the supply closet. And you get away with that, so eventually you start writing yourself checks for petty cash that you spend. And eventually you could become a swindler. He said this thing that I think that is particular to the sexual harassment issue, the workplace hazards that go on. He said there in the United States, there used to be a posted code of ethics in every lunchroom by every time clock, anywhere, and was understood when you took a job, that there was a code of ethics that you had to understand. This is the way you will behave if you work here. There are rules here, and these rules are not governed. They are sort of governed by the law. But when you come into work, you have to understand that there is an ethical code that everybody who walks through these doors has to make part of their personal credo.
Tom Hanks, thank you for your generosity today with this time. I love your book, Uncommon Type. I love the typewriter that I learned to type on, and I still have my late husband's typewriter.
Put them to use.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane. I love talking to you.
And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week, Doug Bell, Al Reynolds, and Jake Cherry. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.